going on, everyone? Welcome to episode 40 of the Data Driven Strength Podcast. Today, myself and Zach are going to be chatting about a recent newsletter we sent out related to the influence of load or percentage of 1 RM on strength gains. We're also going to be kicking off this episode with a quick question from a listener regarding how to kind of attack weaknesses in your training versus leaning into your strengths, which I think is a really important discussion, something that we've kind of changed our minds on over the last 18 months or so, I'd say. So we wanted to hit on that first, and then again, we'll dive into that discussion of the influence of load on strength. I think on the surface, typically think, you know, you lift heavier weights, that's how you maximize strength gains. That's true to some degree, but again, we're going to kind of dive into the nuances a little bit more today. Before Zach reads me into that first listener question, if you appreciate what we do and you get value from the show, it would help us out a lot if you go ahead and leave a rating and review on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you listen to this. And also check out the description of this podcast to see the stuff we offer. Also, make sure you are subscribed to the Training Takeaway newsletter. Every other Tuesday, we're going to be sending out a quick takeaway that's going to be right at the top of every single newsletter. And then below that's going to be, you know, us kind of getting into the weeds and discussing how we came to that takeaway. Typically, they're going to be on a recent study, but sometimes they might kind of be more of a topic review. Sometimes we might kind of lean into, you know, some recent coaching experiences, recent experiences within our individualized programming group, et cetera. So with that sales pitch out of the way, make sure you're signed up to get the coming ones. I think that's everything. Zach, you want to go ahead and kick off this first question from Anonymous because I lost their name.
Okay. So the crux of this question is basically, there is a apparent dichotomy between how to go about improving strength. Should we try to strengthen our weak points, or should we just try to build our natural strengths? That's ultimately what this question is asking. The example they give is somebody with really long femurs, kind of a hip dominant squatter. Should they really try to build up their quads? The assumption in this question is that is their weakness, which I'm sure Josh will talk about. Or should they just really lean into the fact that they're a quote unquote hip dominant squatter, build up their posterior chain and potentially their back, and use that as a way to drive strength?
Yeah, so I'll kind of start with the short answer, and then we'll see if we want to dive into the weeds a little bit more. But the short answer is, for the main lift or kind of the main exercise that you're trying to maximize strength in, so in this case, the back squat, in general, you want to lean into your strengths. So if your hips are really strong and you feel the best and it's most natural for you to be pretty dang bent over, which it sounds like this individual that ask the question, that's the case. That's pretty common, right? To some degree. Lean into that, right? There's no reason to force a position that you're not as strong in. Of course, terms and conditions apply. Shout out to PAC. Terms and conditions apply if, you know, there's anything regarding like aches and pains or tolerance regarding that position, but in general, lean into what you feel best. And as long as you're kind of checking the boxes of the constraints of the movement, if you choose to compete, working within the constraints of that, et cetera. But where I think we've changed our minds is that you kind of think about your positioning for the main lift, and then you think about someone's muscular strength limiter as almost a separate variable. So in other words, just because you're a very hip dominant or very bent over squatter, that doesn't necessarily tell us what your strength limiter is. And this is a pretty complex topic, but I think within the context of a squat, we can kind of dichotomize to some degree what someone's muscular strength limiter would be between it being from the knees or from the hips. So the knee extensors or the hip extensors. Obviously, some people are going to kind of be quote unquote balanced between the two, but There's a theoretical scenario where someone is a bent over squatter and they're limited muscularly by their quads or their knee extensors. There's also a scenario where someone's a really bent over hip dominant squatter, but their muscular limiter is the hips. I just think of those as two totally separate variables. And what that muscular strength limiter informs, in my opinion, is the exercise selection of any hypertrophy focused slots that kind of support the main lift. So within a training week, we will have at least one or two slots for each main lift that are targeting the muscular strength limiter, right? And again, sometimes it's balanced, so sometimes it can be a pretty specific movement. But if you have someone that is limited by their quads and their squat, even if they're a bent over squatter, you're going to try to get them on a machine or in a position that hammers their squats, and that's kind of the limiting, or hammers their quads, and that's kind of the limiting factor. So that's kind of the mental model I use. It would be really explain. It would be tough to kind of explain how to diagnose that limiter, quote unquote, diagnose that limiter without any visuals. So we'll save that for another time. But Zach, what do you think about that mental model?
Yeah, I completely agree. So I'm not going to belabor it too much. I'm just going to add an analogy that probably can help a little bit, just the way that we think about it. I think you've probably heard like the race car analogy for muscle size contribution to strength. I think you can add a little bit of a layer to that, to kind of this conversation as well. So when we're thinking about, you know, the way that we kind of break up programming for a given movement, so like we've been talking about the squat here, we have what we call our quote unquote skill slots, which are things that are focused on making the execution of the task the most efficient, whereas we have our hypertrophy slots where we're focusing on growing the muscles responsible for executing that task. The way that I think about this question to me is that the former, the skill slots, are dedicated towards teaching you how to drive the metaphorical race car as efficiently as possible, which ultimately is going to increase the efficiency at which you can produce force of the things that you're strongest with, in this case, the hips and the squat. So you're kind of getting the inherent ability of the race car to be driven at as close to its maximal capacity as physically possible, which is where the skill slots come in. Tons of practice at heavy loads, executing high degrees of force production from the strongest muscles that you have to lift those heavy weights. On the opposite end of the spectrum, this is where the analogy is probably a little bit more familiar, is that the hypertrophy slots are dedicated towards just overall building a bigger engine of the car, which is going to increase the capacity of the car, to which later training or concurrent training can continue to focus on improving the efficiency at which you can express the slightly increased capacity from that bigger engine. So that's just kind of the ongoing kind of metaphor that we kind of use when we think about this stuff, is that in a way you're really doing both. At the end of the day, the thing that probably drives the capacity the most, at least in our view, is probably the size of the engine of the car, which is going to be mostly driven by the size of the muscles, particularly that are the limiter in the equation here. But you still have a degree of strength that can be improved by learning how to efficiently drive the metaphorical race car, or very efficiently execute the squat to maximally transfer the force capacity that you have from your muscles to actually complete a repetition. So that's the thing I always kind of come back to as a model. Obviously, all models lack a little bit of nuance, but I still think that's a helpful way to think about it.
Yeah. I have a few thoughts in my head of things we could dive into, but we'll kind of call it there. Go ahead, drop a comment in the YouTube video or something if you want us to do a full episode on.
That's a first. Asking for comments. Nice. Let's go. Algorithm.
Literally no one watches on YouTube compared to podcast. So yeah, we'll see how that goes. Okay. Let's start chatting about the newsletter that you sent, Zach. So I kind of alluded to this before, but I think this is a topic that on the surface you might not really bat an eye at, but I think it's actually really vital to understand. And that's the relationship between load and 1RM, and kind of having as good of an understanding of that is going to be helpful, right? We kind of assume that if you want to lift heavy weights, if you want to get stronger lifting maximal weights, you're going to have to lift, you know, pretty close to maximal weights, which is true to some degree. But there's obviously, you kind of need to work backwards from that if you're trying to accumulate sufficient volume or tolerate a sufficient just general workload. So it's like, okay, at what point are we kind of checking that box? Or is there a point at which we kind of check that box in terms of, okay, this is heavy enough to maximize strength gains? Lots of additional kind of nuance there, but hopefully that sets a stage for you to kind of dive into what you talked about in the article, Zach.
Yeah, just like you said, I think when people first initially hear this, like, okay, looking at the percentage of 1RM or the load you're using and 1RM strength gains, that's probably something that a lot of people have heard about and would generally say, okay, if you're given like a comprehension question, heavier loads are going to be better for 1 RM strength gains. I would say that most people in our audience will probably know that. The thing I find interesting about this question, and one of the reasons I kind of wanted to go down this rabbit hole, was that pretty much everything that I'm aware of up until this recent meta-analysis that we have kind of looks at these things like very far on the ends of the spectrum. So just an example, one of the meta-analyses that's often cited to kind of talk about this topic is the Schoenfeld one. And most of the studies included in that are like 80% versus 30% of 1 RM. And so while on the very far ends of the spectrum, load on the heavier side may be better for 1 RM strength gains, when we actually apply this to the way that we would train most of us for the lifts that we care about, 1 RM most often, squat, bench press, deadlift, overhead press, stuff like that, you're almost certainly not training with 30% of 1 RM, probably not even 50% of 1 RM, in the 60s, maybe even pushing it. So the comparison that I thought is the most interesting is this one between moderate and heavy loads. And that's where I kind of started thinking about this question of, okay, on average, and if we're looking at things from a very like all the way across the load spectrum from 0 to 100%, heavier loads are generally going to be better for 1 RM strength gains. But if we isolate that to just the section from, you know, about 60% of 1 RM up, does this relationship decrease how linear it is basically? And our returns on our investment, do those diminish over time? Meaning that as we go from 60 to 70% of 1 RM, maybe we get quite a good bump in the amount of 1 RM strength gain that we would expect. But if we go from 70 to 80 and 80 to 90, maybe that starts to decrease a bit. And so that was kind of the reason I wanted to look into this, and the kind of the spur of this idea was this meta-analysis by Lopez and colleagues. And I really liked the way that they did it, as it broke up the loading ranges a little bit more granularly, that allowed us to kind of have this kernel of something to look into. So just very briefly, and you'll be able to see this very clearly in the newsletter, as Josh mentioned, there the kind of the forest plot that I just very glazed over and made a simplified graphic of. All you need to see is that going from the top to the bottom, the effect sizes get smaller. And so what that means, in the very top one, we're comparing heavy versus low loads. So that's, you know, somewhere around 30% of 1 RM versus 80% of 1 RM, which is what most of the research looks at. Then we have low loads versus moderate loads, and the effect is a little bit smaller. And then we have moderate loads versus heavy loads, and the effect is even smaller. And in a way, you can kind of see that those returns diminish a little bit. As loads get heavier, the differences between the preceding condition are less. And so I saw that and I was like, okay, this is interesting. But there is, you know, without getting too far down the statistics rabbit hole here, there's a little bit to be desired in terms of actually visualizing that relationship in terms of the way that it would trend up to 100% of 1 RM. So while that can be a small indication to say that load may have some diminishing returns as we get heavier, there were some additional steps that we probably should dig into a little bit further to see if that's actually the case. And so that's kind of what the rest of the newsletter did. And so, you know, long story short here, when we look at that at a more visual level, and we're kind of trying to visualize this relationship, is it linear? Does it kind of taper off? What does it look like? We can see that when we just consider all the studies considered in this kind of sub-analysis from this Lopez meta-analysis, there isn't really a strong relationship between the percentage of 1 RM used and the changes that we see within these groups. And so on that face value, you could say, you know, pretty strongly that there does seem to be some sort of diminishing returns or lack of relationship. It's not very linear ultimately. And so then the next question was, okay, looking at the pool of studies we have here, there's a lot of studies that use untrained subjects. And if we're just thinking about this logically, the likelihood that an untrained individual needs a really heavy load to get better at the exercise and ultimately improve their 1 RM strength is probably not nearly as strong as a trained individual. So when we kind of separate those out, that's where I think the little bit of an interesting nugget kind of emerges there, because the relationship, albeit in a limited comparison, not a ton of studies, terms and conditions apply, as you mentioned. The relationships does seem to be stronger in trained individuals versus untrained individuals. And so to me, that kind of does support the idea in a way that, you know, load does seem to play some sort of a role for 1RM strength gains, particularly in trained individuals. And if we consider the individuals in these studies, trained is going to be, you know, I would say early intermediate lifters, if that's probably generous. And for individuals that have been training for a long time, if we're going with this liberally, that may matter even more. And so if we take that on from a practical perspective, that's where things start to get interesting. And that's where we can kind of start to apply these findings. But that was kind of the steps in the process I kind of went through to kind of go through these steps and try to extract some practical nuggets. But I'll pause there, Josh, see if you have anything on kind of just the overarching preamble there, and then we can kind of get into the practical applications.
Yeah. Did you cover like the categorical versus continuous concept?
No, I left that out. I can cover it if you think that's useful.
I think it's helpful to conceptualize it, and I think it just kind of rehashes what you talked about.
Yeah.
So just very, very basically, when you have, you know, different kind of types of data, right? You can have one is called categorical data, where you kind of put things into buckets, right? So that's what they did in this meta-analysis, which is low, moderate, and high loads based on criteria in terms of like, hey, this was below a certain percentage. I can't remember exactly what it was from the paper. So it's quote unquote low load. Same idea for moderate, same idea for high loads. However, that isn't really what we care about. What we care about is within a reasonable range of percentages you might use in training, do we see that the heavier you go, the more strength gains you get? Or do you see that it increases up to a point and then plateaus? Or do you see it's completely flat and maybe you're totally fine just training with 60-70%? We don't know. That's why, Zach, you kind of started to mess around with the data yourself. So I'll kind of let you go into what exactly you did or whatever you want to take.
No, that I actually think that's literally perfect. I'm not going to add anything to that. That's literally the degree of complexity I think that needs to be added. Like it's to be clear, it's what they did is not wrong by any means. It's just answering a slightly different question. So exactly. So what we're interested in is exactly what Josh said. We basically want to make load this continuous variable so we can kind of visualize this relationship. Whereas what they're comparing is within these individual studies, they're kind of making what's called a between group comparison and doing all these statistics to make those within those categorical buckets.
Yeah. Which to be clear, I said, we don't care about that.
Yeah. It's just a different question.
I mean, in practice. Yeah. Of course. I think from a research perspective, in that was 100% the right thing to do.
Yeah.
But that's what we kind of wanted to take that extra layer in a very exploratory way.
For sure.
I'm sure we'll talk about the limitations here, literally three studies. So it wouldn't be appropriate to try to publish a meta regression like this in terms of using it as a continuous variable. So I just want to be clear that
100%.
Not wrong by any means. It's just we're trying to really take this in a practical sense. At the potential cost of this analysis just not being nearly robust enough, but we're okay with that as long as we're obviously communicating it properly. That this is very exploratory, obviously. Terms and conditions apply.
That's three for three. Let's go. I think we're basically just poking around, trying to see if we can find, you know, those things that maybe are something we can test further in the future, or if you're kind of trying to hedge your bets on one side right now, so long as there's not a major downside, that's probably the best way to think about it.
Quick note on, because that's ultimately, we're coming through this, we're coming at this newsletter, you were coming at this newsletter through the lens of a practitioner, not through the lens of a researcher. Obviously, you kind of used research concept and your understanding.
Research tools for practitioners to get the practical nuggets.
Because I want to be clear that when you say poking around, like that wouldn't be the right thing to do from a research perspective. From a research perspective, you want to kind of ask a question and then try to answer it as best as possible with the data.
We could go down this rabbit hole for sure. It wouldn't be the right thing to do in a research sense if you are using that to test a hypothesis. If you're generating hypothesis, maybe it is the right thing to do. So I think that's, in a way, that's kind of what we're doing, right? Is we're using the information we have available and trying to find those things that we can kind of ask the next question that, again, would take more rigorous methods to thoroughly test and mm-hmm. have a ton of confidence in the answer. We don't have that here. Absolutely. Right. But if we are kind of going to sit on one side of the fence, maybe right. this does play a little bit into your decision-making.
And if, as we'll get to, like nothing you found was like statistically significant.
Nope.
But at the end of the day, we're writing programs for people all the time, and we're doing this every day. So it's at least worthwhile to see if it leans in one way or the other.
Yeah. And I think the other thing too is like, this is an interesting, you know, I didn't think we were going to go this direction, but I do think this is interesting, is like, I do think these types of comparisons are helpful because you have observations from coaching, right? And you have observations from practice, but you're obviously biased and you have a lot of things that go into those observations. But if the question or the best available data does lean in the direction of your observations, maybe you can have a little bit more confidence in those observations actually holding true to some degree, which is something, you know, we've talked about in this case. You know, one thing we've had a ton of anecdotal success with is like thinking about these things of trying to prioritize peak load when we can, get average load in a pretty high spot, but mostly based on tolerance, and kind of get those things up higher, generally speaking. And that seems to have favorable effects for strength gains on average. And I think that probably is supported by what we did here, although major grains of salt go with the actual analysis. But I think you kind of take those two things together. And if we're taking this from a practitioner's perspective, I probably sit on that side of the fence a little bit, if that makes sense.
Cool. I'll shut up now and let you kind of talk about
that. Yeah. No, you're good, man. And I think when we kind of split this up by training status, like I said, there did seem to be a slightly stronger relationship for trained individuals than untrained individuals, which I think we would expect. That said, the overall relationship wasn't super duper strong. But as Josh said, there's a ton of limitations to this analysis in terms of there's only really three studies that were moderate to heavy loads included in this meta-analysis that included trained participants. So we're looking at a pretty darn small pool of data here. So again, we're just kind of, you know, exploring a little bit, but take it with a grain of salt. But ultimately, like I said, I do think this seems to make sense if we kind of take our anecdotal coaching experience into account. And then also just like the overall strength community, in my opinion. If we kind of think about the emergence of, you know, first we probably had like the Bulgarian method that kind of made its way into powerlifting. And then I think the hyper-aggressiveness of that approach kind of got tempered a little bit. And now we have people taking very regular, pretty darn heavy top sets essentially year round. There's probably a ton of different ways you can go about organizing that and actually programming it. But the concept there is, for pretty well-trained people, you're trying to organize your programming in a way that allows you to tolerate pretty high loads on a regular basis, ultimately, is what it comes down to. And I think the question then becomes is like, A, there's going to be individual strategies to do that. B, like I mentioned a little bit earlier, there's these two kind of ways we can talk about loading that this analysis has nothing to do with. This is mostly just us talking about coaching and our opinions, honestly, is what's more important, peak versus average loading. We have some kind of database, you know, reasons we may swing in one reason or the other, but I do think there's an interesting kind of teeter-totter there. Like, you can really prioritize peak loading, which generally speaking is going to take a little bit of a decrease in average loading, most likely, or you can be a little bit higher on the average loading side, but your peak's maybe not quite as high. Which of those is preferable? Does it change in the training phase, how far you are from competition? All those kind of things. There's a lot of interesting questions as far as this stuff goes. But ultimately, I think the nugget from this whole thing is that for trained individuals, you're going to try to organize training to generally tolerate heavier loads when strength gains are on the immediate thing on your mind. So like the short to moderate term, you know, you start getting 12 weeks out from a meet prep. I think most of the training variables should probably be organized to allow load to kind of be that predominant thing that we're trying to ultimately drive strength gains. That said, from my coaching experience, and I think you would agree with this as well from your anecdotes, the exact thing, what means heavy loads, quote unquote, is very, very individual. And I base that predominantly from like a tolerance perspective. So I don't try to think as much as possible in like hard percentages of estimated 1RM or 1RM, things like that. I just kind of try to tailor that to the client of what heavy means for them as an individual, and then use some other strategies to try to bump that number up for them when possible.
Yeah. To kind of piggyback off that, I was thinking about examples of like how I use this concept, because ultimately kind of the main takeaway is that the relationship, as you go from kind of that 60 to whatever 90% of 1 RM range, the relationship between load and strength gains seems to be stronger in trained individuals, again, kind of tentatively. So in other words, trained individuals seem to benefit from higher loads potentially more than untrained individuals. So kind of the takeaway is, okay, how do we design training to get exposure to that? I think we're going to kind of focus on peak loading, which again, to be clear, isn't the approach that the research takes. It's all based on average loading. Like none of them have actual top sets.
It's both. It's both, right? Like the average and the peak load are the same, which is why it's difficult to know which one to prioritize in practice, aside from probably some of the things you're going to mention, maybe about the periodization stuff.
Yeah, we'll circle around to the periodization thing, but a quick kind of practical nugget is the way that I like to think about this is almost like a regression, if you will, for each individual in terms of like, at what point do you really see those diminishing returns with load? So like just very casually, the way that I would describe this is a load that is just heavy enough to challenge positioning. So in other words, 50%, like, yeah, you can like practice technique there to get a good feel, but in general, you probably want to load heavy enough to actually challenge positioning so you can get some practice actually kind of working through a sticking point or something like that. For some people, like I'm thinking like bench pressers, specifically like later individuals, that might be in the 92 to 94% range as kind of that threshold. Whereas if you have like, I'm thinking of one athlete I work with specifically where like, man, we just can't touch above 80% on his squat, partly just because he's so dang strong very frequently at all, because he's so dang strong and there's tolerance issues when you go above there. So for him, a load just heavy enough to challenge positioning in terms of percentage of 1 RM is considerably lower. And then there's also the tolerance factor there. So I think in general, yes, heavier loads are going to be better. Trying to arrange things so you get exposures to those peak loads is going to be heavier. The heavier, the better. But you need to work backwards from there based on tolerance, practicality, downstream effects on the rest of the program, the rest of the session as well. So I think that's kind of just the main takeaway is, honestly, the heavier the better, but that doesn't mean you're doing Bulgarian. That means you're working backwards from there based on kind of the other downstream effects within the overall training program.
Money. Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. That's exactly how I think about it is like, we've been meaning to do an episode on this, so I'm not going to go into this too much, but like we kind of start with like that, you know, theoretical / physiological, what theoretically should be the best, but then you have to layer all on all of the practical and individual level considerations to ultimately get the output for what you should probably do. Yeah. And so in this case, basically what Josh is saying is like, you know, if you only had to choose one load to be probably the best practice for strength gains, it's probably going to be up towards 100% of 1 RM, you know, 95 to 100% of 1 RM. That's basically the best way you could practice for that test. However, depending on the lift, depending on the individual's leverages, depending on their psychology and the way that they approach that lift, depending on the overall construction of their training program, do they deadlift after they squat? Like, you know, there's just so many considerations that go into, you know, what exactly quote unquote heavy means for an individual. And when we're trying to push them heavier, what exact percentage of 1 RM that results in, that I don't like giving like recommendations per se of that. Obviously we can give general ranges and everything to like try to shoot within. But if you have clear evidence on the individual level that somebody can't tolerate, you know, let's just say 90% of 1 RM, as Josh's client said, he can't very frequently go over 80% of 1 RM. If you consistently cannot tolerate that, there is absolutely no reason to keep beating your head against the wall in that case, in my opinion. I think you should find those heavy loads that you can tolerate consistently. And of course, you know, try to familiarize yourself and maybe push that up a little bit over time here and there, but very much sticking within the tolerance bounds of that individual, and then using the other training variables that you have to your have your exposure to maybe manipulate those a little bit to help with the recovery demands that come with heavy load training. So a few things I mentioned at the very end of the article, didn't go into a ton of depth on this, but just a few things to touch on. You know, you have like things like the, you know, the way that you organize your sets, the proximity to failure. We talk about this a lot. You know, instead of doing back off sets that are really close to failure, doing a strength oriented phase, maybe you kind of manipulate the set structure there to have those a little bit farther from failure at the same load. So just as a very basic example, instead of three sets of six at 80%, maybe go six sets of three at 80% for your back off sets. And that may allow you to tolerate that single at 90% a little bit longer, or maybe just at all. Another way you could do it is, you know, we talked about a little bit earlier on the exercise selection and how we like to think about that for a given lift. This is another reason we really like to find something that an individual can tolerate really well. And the ROI per set is really, really solid for their hypertrophy movements. So instead of just banging your head against the wall with like really fatiguing exercises that maybe aren't even really targeting the muscular strength limiter that you may have, maybe finding something that's a little bit more efficient may allow you to tolerate heavier loads on those lifts that you're actually trying to improve strength on. So that's another way to do it. And there's a bunch of other factors that can kind of go with a similar logic. And you can see what I'm doing there. I'm making adjustments to all the other variables to try to prioritize load, which out of all the variables for 1RM strength, that's probably the thing that's the most predictive of the loads that you're generally training with. And this probably is especially the case in trained individuals. That's essentially the idea.
Perfect. I want to include this question from Cole, who responded to the newsletter, and I thought it was a good question, so I wanted to include it here. Shout out to Cole for reading, and he's also part of the individualized programming group. So appreciate you, Cole. Appreciate the question. So I'm going to kind of paraphrase this the best I can. So basically the question is like, hey, should you use, like, if heavy loads, using very heavy loads consistently comes at a recovery cost, would it be more effective to have a top set and then back off sets year round? Or would you just kind of wave load intensity? So would you kind of go like, all right, we're using 70% on average for the first block, then 80% on average for the next block, and then 90% on average. So it's very, very much kind of like a traditional linear periodization approach where load increases. Or would you take a top set back off approach year round so you can keep those heavy exposures year round? What do you think?
Short answer, we don't know. Just like we talked about a little bit earlier, the research simply isn't set up to answer that question. So this is almost entirely, you know, coaching experience, practice driven from an answer. Like, we would need a study that basically looks, isolates peak load with different average loads, or sorry, isolates peak load with the same average load, or changes average load with the same peak load, to be able to see which one of those is the more important, and that kind of thing, which we just don't have. So Josh, I think you know the slight tangent argument from the periodization literature that would be helpful here. So I'll leave that to you. But in my experience, I think that it does seem to be pretty individual. I would say my default approach is kind of prioritizing that top set, having that more often. The way that I often frame this is like, the reason this is my default is because, you know, if you think of like a traditional linear periodization, you start with sets of 12, then you go into a block of sets of sixes, maybe a block of threes, and then you get into a block with singles. When you're doing that sets of 12, you kind of forget a little bit how to, you know, how a heavyweight feels. Like Josh said, a load that's heavy enough to require you to fight to hold your position from the second that it's on your back, things like that. There's a lot of soft skills that go along with, like, you know, lifting loads that are close to your 1RM. And I think just having some sort of exposure to that, even, you know, even if it isn't a single, or even if it isn't super duper heavy, I think can still be pretty useful. So my general
scientific term,
super duper. Yeah. But so I think having those around in some fashion is probably a good idea for most people, but I don't necessarily think these have to be mutually exclusive either. I think you can kind of gradually increase the one, which is what I often do, and kind of gradually increase the loading on both of these. So you can start with a pretty light top set, little bit lighter back offs, and both of those can kind of linearly increase a little bit as you get close to competition. The rate of increase might be a little bit different between the two depending on your style, but ultimately I think this is pretty individual. I've had people that, you know, I use more of like a block to block approach where everything kind of increases in load. I've had a lot of people that I kind of increase or include a top set kind of all the time and have that exposure. I would say that's a majority of the people that I've worked with. I find that to be pretty effective, but I've kind of seen all those strategies be effective in some cases. But I think the key, like I said at the end there, was that I don't think these have to be totally mutually exclusive. It's just the degree at which you polarize them.
Yep, that's right on. I basically would always include a top set. It's just a matter of the nature of that top set. That might be sevens for someone that can't tolerate much heavier, or psychologically they just kind of need a break, whatever, that kind of thing. And maybe that'll kind of periodize down to singles or doubles in that final block. I still kind of view that as a heavier load approach. Even if it's back off sevens, maybe it's after a 10% load drop. That just gives you, you know, a set of seven at eight at like an eight or nine RPE. You know, that's obviously not a traditional top set you might think about, but you know, you're starting to get into the close to the 80% or low 80% type range. You know, you're getting a little bit of skill practice there. I think if you like the transition from going to that range to high 80s and then low 90s, mid 90s, I think that can be pretty smooth. Where I would really warn, or I would probably suggest against on average, is hanging out just at 70% for an extended period of time, or just at 60%. Besides, you know, whatever, a few week kind of break from hard training if someone needs it for psychological or life reasons, etc. But yeah, I think I would really double down on what you said in that they're both, our typical approach is that they're both periodized. Both that top set and the back offs are periodized, but that kind of polarization is always there to some degree. The degree of polarization, in my opinion, is probably one of the most important things to individualize. So yeah, I think we covered that well. Zach, got anything to add? Cool. Thank you all for tuning in. We will see you in a couple weeks. If you haven't already, we would much appreciate you leave a rating and review for us on the podcast. Make sure you're signed up for the newsletter as well. We'll make that the first link in the description. And we'll see you next time. Take care.
Thanks, everybody.